You're trying to keep me awake, aren't you?
You landed on your head faint. For a time there, you spoke in tongues.
I did what?
Well, it was a mix of languages, 16 that I could identify, and some others I could not. An extraordinary display feint. There is a scholar who states that we possess every language deep within our minds, and that the potential exists for perhaps 10,000 languages in all. She would have delighted in witnessing your feat. Then there is a distigia, a dissector of human corpses living in Erlitan, who claims that the brain is nothing more than a clumped mass of snarled chains. Most links are fused, but some are not. Some can be prized open and fitted anew. Any major head injury, he says, can result in a link breaking. This is usually permanent, but on rare occasions a new link is forged. Chains faint, packed inside our skull.
Only they don't look like chains, do they?
No, alas, they don't. It is the curse of theory disconnected from physical observation. Of course, Icarium would argue that one should not always test theory solely on the basis of pragmatic observation. Sometimes, he would say, theory needs to be interpreted more poetically, as metaphor, perhaps.
I have a metaphor for you, Mappo.
Oh?
A woman lies on the ground, brain addled, listening to a hairy trell with tusks discussing possible interpretations of theory. What does this mean?
I don't know. But whatever it may be, I doubt it would qualify as a metaphor.
I'm sure you're right. Since I don't even know what a metaphor is, truth be told. Try this, then. The woman listens to all that, but she knows her brain is addled. So, just how addled is it? Is it so addled that she actually believes she's listening to a hairy trell spouting philosophy?
Oh, perhaps a tautology, then. Or some other manner of unprovable proof. Then again, it might well be something else entirely. Though I am occasionally philosophical, I do not claim to be a philosopher. The distinction is important, I'm sure.
If you really want to keep me awake, Mappo, find a new subject.
Do you truly believe Precious Thimble is capable of taking you back to Darujistan?
If she isn't, we're stuck, and it's time to start learning the local tongue from Setok. But she can't be from here anyway, can she? This land is blasted. Quell says it's used up, exhausted. No one can live here.
The cut of Setok's clothing is bargast, said Mappo. He scratched the bristle on his jaw. And since that boy has, I think, bargast blood, he raised his voice and, in bargast, called over to Setok. Do we share this language between us, Destrient Setok?
At the question, all four newcomers looked over, and Setok said,
It seems we do.
Nice guess, said Faint.
Observation and theory, Mappo replied. Now, you can rest for a short time. I mean to get the story of these strangers. I will be back to wake you anon.
Can't wait, Faint muttered.
If no solution serves, ventured Shield Anvil Tanakalian, then what remains to us? We must proceed on the path we have always known, until some other alternative presents itself.
He held his gaze on the entourage of Queen Abrastol as it slowly drew closer, a dozen or so horses gently cantering across the uneven ground, the pennons above the riders flapping like impaled birds. Beside him, mortal sword Krughava shifted heavily on her saddle. Leather creaked, iron scraped.
The absence haunts, she said. It gapes at our side, sir.
Then choose one, mortal sword. Be done with it. Her expression darkened beneath the rim of her helm.
You truly advise this, Shield Anvil? Am I to be so desperate as to be careless? Must I swallow my dissatisfaction? I have done this once already, sir, and I begin to find regret in that.
Once already? You miserable witch. I took that sour face of yours to be the one you always wear. Now you tell me I was a choice made without confidence. Did that old man talk you into it, then?
But between you and me, woman, only I was witness to his bitter dissatisfaction at the very end. So, in your mind, he still argues in my favour. Well enough. It grieves me, mortal sword, to hear you say this. I do not know how I have failed you, nor do I know what reparation remains available to me.
My indecision, sir, stings you into impatience. You urge action without contemplation. But if the selection of a new destriant does not demand contemplation, what possibly can? In your mind, it would seem, these are but titles, responsibilities one grows into, as it were. But the truth of it is, the title awaits only those who have already grown into a person worthy of the responsibility. From you, I receive all the irritation of a young man convinced of his own rightness, as young men generally are, said conviction leading you into rash impulses and ill-considered advice. Now I ask that you be silent. The Queen arrives.
Tanakalian struggled against his fury, endeavouring to hold flat his expression in the face of the Balkando riders. You strike me in the moment before this parley to test my self-control. I know all your tactics, mortal sword. You shall not best me. Queen Abrastel wasted little time.
We have met with the Safie emissary, and I am pleased to inform you that resupply is forthcoming, at a reasonable price, I might add. Generous of them, all things considered.
Indeed, Highness, said Krughava.
Furthermore, Abrastel continued, the Malazan columns have been sighted by the Safie, almost due north of the Safie Mountains, approaching the very edge of the wastelands. They have made good time. Curiously, your allies are with escort, none other than Prince Bryce Bedict, in command of a Lethary army.
I see, said Krughava. And this Lethary army now marches well beyond Lethar's borders, suggesting their role as escort was not precautionary.
The Queen's eyes sharpened.
As I said, most curious, mortal sword.
She paused and then said,
it has become obvious to me that of all the luminaries involved in this escapade, I alone remain ignorant.
Highness?
Well, you are all marching somewhere, yes? Into the wastelands, no less. And through them, in fact, into Kalance. My warnings to you of the grim, no, horrifying situation in that distant land appear to have gone unheeded.
On the contrary, Queen Abrastel, said Krughava. We heed them most assiduously, and hold your concern in the highest regard.
Then answer me. Do you march to win yourselves an empire? Kalance, weakened so by internal strife, drought and starvation, must present to you an easy conquest. Surely you cannot imagine such a beleaguered people to be your deadliest enemy. You've never even been there. If, she added, you were wondering why I am still with you and the Kundril, so far from my own realm and still weeks to go before our grand parley with the adjunct, perhaps now you can surmise my reasons.
Curiosity?
Krughava asked, brows lifting. A flash of irritation lit Abrastel's features. Yes, Queen, I know how you feel.
A more apt description would be unease. As co-ruler of Balkando, it is my responsibility to hold tight the reins of my people. I am well aware of the human tendency towards chaos and cruelty. The very purpose of rule, as I hold it, is to enforce civility. To achieve this, I must begin with a personal adherence to the same. Does it distress me that I am perhaps aiding a horde of rabid conquerors? Does it sit well with my conscience that I am assisting in the invasion of a distant kingdom?
At the earning of vast profits from us, Krughava said, one would conclude that much civility can be purchased for yourself, Highness, and for your people, at no direct cost or burden to you, I might add.
She was genuinely angry now, Tanakalian could see, this hard, clear-eyed queen sitting astride her horse in the insignia of a soldier. A true ruler of her people,
a true servant of the same.
Mortal sword, I am speaking of conscience.
It was my understanding, Highness, that coin in sufficient quantities could serve anything. Is this not the belief dominating Lether and Safinand, and indeed Balkando?
Then you do in truth seek to descend upon the poor people of Colance?
If it is so, Highness, should you not be relieved? After all, even without the Malazans, we were at the very walls of your capital. To win ourselves a kingdom, well, yours was entirely within our reach, without need for further marching and all the hardships that entails. As for the Malazans, why, they have just completed a successful conquest of the Empire of Lether, a most opulent nest, were they inclined to settle in it.
This is precisely my point,
Abrastel snapped, tugging her helm to loose a cascade of fiery, sweat-strung hair.
Why Colance? What in the errant's name do you want with Colance?
Highness, said Krughaver, unperturbed by the Queen's uncharacteristic outburst, an answer to that question would find you in a difficult situation.
Why?
Because you speak to me of conscience. By withholding explanation of our purpose, Highness, we leave to you the comfort of the solitary consideration of your own people. You are their queen, after all, and therein lies the crucial difference between us. We perish begin and end with responsibility only to ourselves and to the purpose of our existence. The same is true for war leader Gaul and the burnt tears. And finally, and most importantly, an identical circumstance obtains among the Bone Hunters. She cocked her head a fraction. Prince Bryce, however, may soon find himself facing a difficult decision, to return to Lether or to continue accompanying the Adjunct and her allies.
And so, retorted Abrastel, in serving only yourselves, you are prepared to deliver misery and suffering upon a broken people?
While this is not our desire, Highness, it may well come to that. In the shocked silence that followed, Tanakalian saw the Queen's eyes flatten, and then a frown slowly knot her brow. The skittering clouds of uncertainty edged into her expression. When she spoke, it was a whisper.
You will not explain yourself to me, will you, mortal sword?
You have the truth of that, Highness.
You say you serve none but yourselves. The assertion rings false.
I am sorry you think so, Krughaver replied.
In fact, Abrastel went on, I now begin to suspect the very opposite.
The mortal sword said nothing. You have the truth of it, Tanakalian silently answered, mocking Krughaver's own words. What we do is not in service to ourselves, but to all of you. Can anything be more glorious? And if we must fall, if we must fail, as I believe we will, is no end sweeter than that? The grandest failure this world has ever seen. Yes, we all know the tale of Coltane's fall outside Arran. But what we shall find at the end of our days will beggar that tale. We seek to save the world, and the world will do all it can to stop us. Watch us lose. Watch us squeeze the blood from your stony heart. But no, there shall be none to witness. If existence itself can be said to be poetic, we stand in that silence, unyielding servants to anonymity. None to see, none to even know. Not a single grave, nor stone lifted to cast shade upon our scattered bones. Neither hill nor tomb. We shall rest in emptiness, not forgotten, for forgetting follows remembrance, and there shall be no remembrance. His heart thundered with the delicious beauty of it, all of it. The perfect hero is one whose heroism none sees. The most precious glory is the glory lost on senseless winds. The highest virtue is the one that remains forever hidden within oneself.
Do you understand that, mortal sword? No, you do not.
He watched, flushed with satisfaction, as Queen Abrastel gathered her reins and pitched her horse about with a vicious twist. The entire entourage hastened to follow. The gentle canter was gone, awkward jostling knotting the troop like a hand twisting cloth, stretching out confused behind their departing queen.
Gift me with your wisdom, Shield Anvil.
Her dry request made him start. The flush of heat in his face suddenly fed darker feelings. They will leave us, mortal sword. The Balkando are done with us. She snorted.
How long must I wait?
For what, mortal sword?
For wisdom in my shield anvil.
They were as good as alone, the Perish camp settled behind them. It seems I can say nothing that pleases you, mortal sword.
Queen Abrastel needs to understand what we intend. She cannot let it go. Now she will maintain her resolve in the hope that the adjunct Tavare will provide her with satisfaction.
And will she?
What do you think, Shield Anvil?
I think Queen Abrastel will be a very frustrated woman.
Finally, yes.
The adjunct is selfish, said Tanakalian. Krukhava's head snapped round.
Excuse me?
She could invite others to share in this glory. This Evertine Legion of the Queens, it looks to be a formidable army. Well-trained, capable of marching in step with us, unlike the Conquestor of Alt's soldiers. Were they to stand at our side in Kalantz?
Sir, cut in the mortal sword, if the adjunct is selfish for what you clearly imagine to be a glorious achievement, then it may serve you better to consider that selfishness as one of unprecedented mercy.
I am aware of the likely outcome of this venture, mortal sword.
Perhaps more than even you. I know the souls awaiting me. I see their mortal faces every day. I see the hope they settle upon me. Nor am I regretful that what we seek shall be unwitnessed, for with our brothers and sisters, I am their witness. When I spoke of the adjunct's selfishness, I did not mean it as a criticism. Rather, I was indicating the privilege I feel in her permitting the Grey Helms to share her fate.
Krukhava's bright blue eyes were fixed on him, calculating, thoughtful.
I understand, sir. You await the death of the Grey Helms. While you look upon them and see naught but their souls soon to be gifted to you, what do they see in the eyes of their shield anvil?
I shall honor them all, Tanakalian replied.
Will you?
Of course, I am shield anvil.
Will you embrace the soul of every brother and sister, free of judgment, unsullied in your love for each and every one of them? And what of our enemies, sir? Will you take them into your arms as well? Will you accept that suffering defies boundaries and that pain carves no line in the sand?
He was silent. How could he answer her? She would see the lie. Tanakalian looked away. I am Shield Anvil to the Perish Grey Helms. I serve the Wolves of Winter. I am the mortal flesh of war, not the sword in its hand. He glanced back at her. Do I crowd your throne, mortal sword? Is that what all this is about? Her eyes widened.
You have given me much to consider, Shield Anvil. Leave me now.
As he walked back into the camp, he drew a deep breath and shakily let it out. She was dangerous, but then he'd always known that.
She actually thinks we can win.
Well, I suppose that is the role of the mortal sword. She is welcome to the delusion. No doubt it will serve well our brothers and sisters when the wolves howl. As for me, I cannot be so blind, so willfully defiant of the truth. We can manage this between us, mortal sword. I will follow your will in not choosing a destriant. Why share the glory? Why muddle things at all? A difficult, searing conversation, but he'd survived it yet.
Yes, Now we understand each other. It is well.
After the shield anvil was gone, the mortal sword stood for a time, eyes on the gloom rising skyward in the east. Then she turned and gestured with one gauntleted hand. A runner quickly joined her.
Send word to War Leader Gaul. I will visit him this evening, one bell after supper.
The soldier bowed and departed. She studied the eastern horizon once more. The mountains surrounding the kingdom of Safinand formed a jagged wall to the north, but there in the place of Dark's birth, there was no hint of anything but level plain, the wastelands. She would suggest to Gaul that they march hard now, taking up stores from the Safi traders as they went. It was imperative that they link up with the adjunct as soon as possible. This was one of the matters she wished to discuss with Gaul. There were others. A long, sleepless night awaited her. The Gilk war chief grinned as he watched Queen Abrastel ride back into the camp. Fire hair, indeed. Flames were ready to spit out from her, from every place an imaginative man might imagine. And, of course, he was a most imaginative man. But a woman like that, well, far beyond his reach, and more's the pity as far as he was concerned. Spoltatha had emerged from his tent behind him and now edged up on his right. Her eyes, so like her mother's, narrowed as they tracked the woman's approach.
"Trapel," she said. "Stay away from her, Spax, for this night at least."
His grin broadened.
"Afraid I can't do that, wild cat."
"Then you're a fool. Keep the furs warm," he said, setting out for the Queen's pavilion.
Soldiers of the Evertine Legion watched him stride past their posts, and he was reminded of a pet lion he'd once seen in the camp of another clan. It had had the freedom of the camp and was in the habit of sauntering back and forth in front of the cages crowded with hunting dogs. Those beasts were driven into a frenzy, flinging themselves bloody and stupid against the iron bars. He'd always admired that lion, its perfect insouciant strut, its lolling tongue, and the itch that always made it pause directly opposite the cages for a leisurely scratch and then a broad yawn. Let the eyes track him. Let them glitter beneath the rims of their helms. He knew these soldiers so wanted to test themselves against the white-faced Bargast, against the Gilk, who were the match of any civilized heavy infantry unit anywhere in the world. But they had little chance of ever doing so. The next best thing was to stand beside them, and that was a competition the Gilk well understood.
"Now we shall see what will come to pass. Do we all march to a place of battle against an enemy? Who will stand fastest? Evertine, Greyhelms, Cundrill, or the Gilk? Ha!"
Spax reached the inner cordon and grunted a nod when the last bodyguard outside the pavilion stepped to one side. He strode into the silk-walled corridor with all its pale tones backlit by lanterns, and as always felt he was walking through colour itself, soft and dry and strangely cool, one flavour after another. One of her trusted lieutenants stood at the last portal. As Spax approached, the lieutenant shook his head.
"Can it not wait, war chief?"
"No, Gaiadis. Why, is she bathing?"
"If she is, the water's long since boiled away."
"What did that iron woman say to Abrastel? Brave enough to announce me, Gaiadis?"
"It's not bravery that makes me say yes, war chief, but then stupidity's gotten me this far, and I'm a conservative man."
"The offer still stands," Spax said.
"I doubt my queen would take kindly to one of her court lieutenants shucking all this to wear turtle shells and dance naked under the moon."
Spax smiled.
"Saw that, did you?"
Gaiadis nodded.
"It was a show, you understand, don't you?"
"War chief?"
"The queen's clutch of scholars. We made something up to give them something to write about, and then ponder its meaning for the rest of their dull, useless lives. Spirits below, a man's grapes get tiny in the cold night.
Why do you think we kept jumping over the fire?
After a moment's gimlet regard, Gaedis turned and slipped through the drapery. Spax hummed softly to himself. Gaedis's muffled voice invited him to enter the royal presence.
Naked in the bowl? Wondered Spax. Bah, the gods are never so kind.
She stood in her underquilting, armor discarded, her long hair still tousled from the ride. The quilting was tight against her curves.
If eyes were paint, Abrastel said, I'd be dripping right now. Barbaric bastard, what's so important you dare my ill humor?
Just this, Highness, Spax replied. She struck sparks from you, and I want to know how and why.
Oh, you're curious then.
That's it, Firehair.
If it wasn't that your rabid warriors might complain, I'd see you strangled with your own entrails, and perhaps, just perhaps, that would satisfy my desire in this moment. Arrogance is a strange thing, Spax. It amuses when it cannot reach, then stings to rage when it can. What in the errant's empty skull convinced you that I'd yield to your shit-fouled curiosity?
Spax glanced across at Gaedis, saw the man's face and the expression that seemed carved from stone.
Coward. Highness, I am war chief of the Gilk. Each day I am under siege from the clan leaders, not to mention the bolder of the young warriors, who'd wage war on the wind if they had any chance of winning. They don't complain of the coin, Highness, but they want a fight.
Volcando is at peace, Abrastel replied. At least it was when you were first hired, and now it is so again. If it was war you wanted, Spax, you should have stayed with the other white faces, since they went and jumped with both feet onto a hornet's nest.
She faced him, and he saw all the places he could put his hands, given the chance. Her expression darkened.
You are war chief, as you say. A proud title, one with responsibility, one assumes. You are under siege, Spax? Deal with it.
Not many arrows left in my quiver, Highness.
Do I look like a Fletcher?
You look like someone with something on her mind.
Spax spread his broad, scarred hands.
I don't know these perish grey helms, but I know of the Order, Highness.
What Order?
The Warrior Cult of the Wolves. A chapter of that cult defended at the Siege of Capustan. The Grey Swords, they were called.
Abrastel studied him for a time, and then she sighed.
Gaedis, open us a jug of wine. But don't even think of pouring yourself one. I'm still annoyed with you for letting this cattle dog whine his way into my presence.
The lieutenant saluted and walked to the ornate wooden frame bearing a dozen or so amphorae, drawing a small knife as he scanned the stamps on the dusty necks.
Cults, mortal swords, shield anvils, and wolf gods, Abrastel said in a mutter, shaking her head. This has the stink of fanaticism, and that well matches my assessment after this evening's parley. Is it simply war they seek, Spax? One where any face will do?
The war chief watched as Gaedis selected a jug and then, with an expert hook and twist of his knife, deftly removed the cork.
Impressive, Lieutenant. You learn that between off-handed swordsmanship and riding backwards?
Pay attention to me, barked Abrastel. I asked you a question, you island of fleas.
Spax tilted his head in something between deference and amused insolence. When he saw the flaring of her eyes, he bared his teeth and snapped out,
As long as you feel inclined to spit out insults, Highness, I will indeed stand as an island. Let the seas crash. The stones will not blink.
Errant's shithole throne. Pour that wine, Gaedis.
Wine sloshed. Abrastel walked over to her cot and sat down. She rubbed her eyes with the palms of her hands and then looked up in time to accept a goblet. She drank deep.
Another, damn you!
Geirdis managed to get the second goblet into Spax's hand before turning about to retrace his steps.
Never mind the perish for now. You say you know these Malazans, Spax. What can you tell me of this adjunct Tavare?
Specifically? Almost nothing, Highness. Never met her, and the Bargast have never crossed her path. No, what I can do is tell you about the cant of the Malazan military, as it took shape at the hands of Dasem Ultor, and the way the command structure changed.
It's a start. But first, what does her title mean? Adjunct? To whom? To what?
Not sure this time round,
the war chief admitted after swallowing down a mouthful of wine.
They're a renegade army, after all. So why hold on to the old title? Because it's what her soldiers are used to, I suppose. Or is there more to it? Highness, the adjunct, as far as I've gathered, was the weapon-bearing hand of the Empress. Her murderer, if you like. Of rivals inside the Empire, enemies outside it. Slayer of sorcerers, she carries an Otataral weapon, proof against any and all manner of magic.
Abrastel remained sitting through this, only to rise once more when he paused. She held out her empty goblet and Geirdis poured again.
Elite, then, specially chosen. How many of these adjuncts did this Empress have at any one time?
Spax frowned.
I think one.
The Queen halted.
And this Malazan Empire, it spans three continents?
And more, Highness.
Yet Tavare is a renegade. The measure of that betrayal...
She slowly shook her head.
How can one trust this adjunct? It is impossible. I wonder, did this Tavare attempt to usurp her Empress? Is she even now being pursued? Will the enemy they find be none other than her Malazan hunters?
Spax shrugged.
I doubt the Grey Helms would care much either way. It's a war, as you said. Any face will serve. As for the Khandril, well, they're sworn to the adjunct personally, so they will follow her anywhere.
Yes, and why would they do that to a betrayer?
Highness, this is none of our concern, said Spax. As much as my warriors lust for a fight, we have put ourselves at a tactical disadvantage. After all, it would have been better to deal with the Khandril and the Perish back in Balkando, and then take on the Bone Hunters later. Mind you, it's still possible. A secret emissary to the Safi, a few tens of thousands of coins, we could catch them by surprise.
No, after all, Spax, if it truly is none of our concern, as you say, why attack them at all?
Just my point, Highness. I was simply observing that our opportunity for a tactical advantage is fast disappearing, assuming we had cause, which we haven't.
I'm not prepared to make any such assumption, Warchief. Thus my dilemma. It is as you describe. None of the three foreign armies still poses us any threat. They have made plain their desire to vanish into the east. Is it time to dust off our hands and return to our beloved homeland?
It might be, Highness.
But then, and her frown deepened. Very well, she said. I have sent a daughter eastward by sea, Spax, a most precious daughter. It seems you and I share the same curse, curiosity. Colance has fallen silent. Our trader ships find nothing but empty ports, abandoned villages. The Palacia Sea is empty of traffic. Even the great net ships have vanished. And yet, something is there, perhaps deep inland. A power, and it's growing.
Spax studied the Queen. She was not dissembling. He saw her fear for her daughter.
Gods, woman, you got enough of them. What's the loss of one?
And it was genuine.
Your heiress? Does it work that way in Balkando? How should I know, when I don't even care? Summon her to return, Highness.
Too late, Spax. Too late.
Highness, said the war chief, Do you mean to tell me we're going with the foreigners across the wastelands?
Gaedis had frozen in place, two strides to one side where he had been about to open another jug. The lieutenant's eyes were on his queen.
I don't know, Abrustel said eventually. No, in fact, we are not equipped for such a venture, nor, I imagine, would they even welcome us. Nonetheless, I will see this adjunct.
She fixed Spax with a look that told him her tolerance was at an end, and she said,
Chew on what you've heard this night, Warchief, and if your stomach still growls, do not bring your complaints to my tent.
Spax dipped his head and then handed his goblet to Gaedis.
I hear your maid's readying that bath, Highness. A most restorative conclusion to this night, I'm sure. Good night to you, Highness, Lieutenant.
Once outside, he set out, not back to his clans, but to the encampments of the Burned Tears. It had occurred to him, when envisioning the grand parley to come, that he and Gaul would, in all likelihood, be the only men present. An exciting notion. He wasn't sure Gaul would see it that way, of course, if the rumours he'd picked up were true, but there was another rumour that, if accurate, could offer a common rug for them both.
Not a drinker of fancy wines, this Gaul. No, the man likes his beer, and if manhood has any measure, it's that. Just my opinion, mind. Now, let's see, War Leader Gaul, if you share it.
Stepping beyond the Legion's last row of tents, Spax paused. He spat to get that foul taste from his mouth.
Wines for women. Gaedis, I bet that trick with the cork has spread 1,000 soft thighs. You'll have to teach it to me one day.
She might as well have tied a cask of ale to her belly. Her lower back was bowed, and every shift of weight made the bones creak. Muscles quivered, others were prostrate with exhaustion. Her breasts, which had never been modest or spry, now sat resting uneasy on the swell of that damned cask. Everything was swollen and too big. How was it that she kept forgetting? Of course, amidst all these groans and shuffles and grunts, her thoughts swam through honey. So sweet, this drowning. The world glowed, life shouted, sang.
Hoary witches of old, she muttered under her breath. You've a lot to answer for.
There was no possible position in which to sit in comfort, so Hanavat, wife to Gaul, had taken to walking through the camp each night. She was the wandering moon of her people's legends in the ages before her sister Moon's betrayal, when love was still pure and night lay down in the arms of darkness. Oh, the legends were quaint, if ever tainted with sorrow, that inevitable fall from grace. She wondered if such creations, those tales of times lost, were nothing more than a broken soul's embrace of regret. The fall was insensibility's wake, too late to do anything about, but this, look around, this is what it made of us. The moon had ceased to wander. Snared in the webs of deceit, it could only slide round and round the world it loved, never to touch, doomed to tug at its lover's tears, that and nothing more. Until, in some distant future, love died, and with it all the pale fires of its wonder, and at last night found her lover, and in turn darkness swallowed her whole. And that was the end of all existence. Hanavat could look up now and see a vision that did not fit with the legend's prophecy. No, the moon had been struck a mortal blow. She was dying, and still the web would not release her, whilst, ever cool, ever faint, her sister Moon watched on. Had she murdered her rival? Was she pleased to witness her sister's death throes? Hanavat's gaze strayed southward to the jade lances arcing ever closer. The heavens were indeed at war.
Tea, Hanavat?
Her attention, drawn down from the skies, found the shapes of two women seated round a small fire banked against the steaming pot.
Shelamasa, Rafala.
Rafala, who'd been the one voicing the offer, now lifted into view a third cup.
"We see you pass each night, Mahib. Your discomfort is plain to our eyes. Will you join us? Rest your feet." "I was fleeing the midwives,"
Hanavat said. She hesitated and then waddled over.
"The seed wakeners are cruel. What's wrong with just an egg? We could manage one, I think, about the size of a palm nut."
Shalamasa's laugh was low and wry.
"But not as hard, I'd hope." "Or as hairy,"
Rafala added. The two warrior women laughed. Grunting, moving slowly, Hanavat sat down, forming the third point to this triangle surrounding the fire. She accepted the cup, studied it in the soft light. Pewter, Volcando.
"So you didn't sell everything back to them, I see." "Only the useless things," Rafala said. "They had plenty of those." "It's what makes us so different from them,"
observed Shalamasa.
"We don't invent useless things or make up needs that don't exist. If civilization, as they call it, has a true definition, then that must be it. Don't you think, Mahib?"
The ancient honorific for a pregnant woman pleased Hanavat. Though these two were young, they remembered the old ways and all the respect those ways accorded people.
"You may be right in that, Shalamasa. But I wonder, perhaps it's not the objects that so define a civilization. Perhaps it's the attitudes that give rise to them, and to the strangely overwrought value attached to them. The privilege of making useless things is the important thing, since it implies wealth and abundance, leisure and all the rest."
"Wise words," murmured Rafala.
"The tea is sweet enough," replied Hanavat.
The younger woman smiled, accepting the faint admonishment with good grace.
"The child kicks," said Hanavat, "and so promises me the truth of the years awaiting us. I must have been mad."
She sipped tea.
"What brew is this?"
"Safi," answered Shalamasa. "It's said to calm the stomach, and with the foreign food we've been eating of late, such calm will be a welcome respite."
"Perhaps," added Rafala, "it will soothe the child as well, or kill it outright. At this point, I don't really care which. Heed this miserable Mahib's warning. Do this once to know what it means, but leave it at that. Don't let the dream serpents back into your thoughts, whispering to you of pregnancy's bliss. The snake lies to soften your memories, until there is nothing but clouds and the scent of blossoms in your skull, and before you know it, you've gone and done it again."
"Why would the serpents lie, Mahib? Are not children women's greatest gift?"
"So we keep telling ourselves and each other."
She sipped more tea. Her tongue tingled as if she'd licked a bell of pepper.
"But not long ago, my husband and I invited our children to a family feast. And my, how we did feast. Like starving wolves trying to decide which among us was the stranded Bedouin calf. All night our children flung that bloody hide back and forth, each of them cursed to wear it at least once, and finally they all decided to drape the two of us in that foul skin. It was, in short, a most memorable reunion."
The two younger women said nothing.
"Parents," resumed Hanavat, "may choose to have children, but they do not choose their children. Nor can children choose their parents. And so there is love, yes, but there is also war. There is sympathy, and there is the poison of envy. There is peace, and that peace is the exhausted calm between struggles for power. There is, on rare occasions, true joy. But each time that precious, startling moment then dwindles, and in each face you see a hint of sorrow, as if what was just found will now be forever remembered as a thing lost. Can you be nostalgic for the instant just past? Oh, yes, and it's a bittersweet taste."
She finished her tea.
"That whispering serpent, it's whispered its last lie in me. I strangled the bitch. I tied it neck and tail to two horses. I collected every knuckled bone and crushed it to dust, then blew that dust to contrary winds. I took its skin and made it into a codpiece for the ugliest dog in the camp. I then took that dog."
Rafala and Shalamassa were laughing, their laughs getting louder with each antic of vengeance Hanavat described. Other warriors, round other small fires, were all looking over now, smiling to see old, pregnant Hanavat regaling two younger women. And among the men there were stirrings of curiosity and perhaps a little unease, for women possessed powerful secrets, and none more powerful than those possessed by a pregnant woman. One need only to look into the face of a Mahib to know that. The women, watching on, but like their male companions too distant to hear Hanavat's words, also smiled. Was that to soothe the men in their company? Possibly. But if so, the expression was instinctive, a dissembling born of habit. No, they smiled as the urgent whispers of their dream serpents filled their heads.
The child within, such joy, such pleasure. Put away the swords, O creature of beauty. Instead, sing to the seed-wakeners. Catch his eye and watch him fall in. The darkness beckons and the night is warm.
Was a scent released upon the air? Did it drift through the entire camp of the Kundril burned tears? In the war leader's campaign tent, Gaul sat with a bellyful of ale, heavy as a cask, leaning on his belt, and eyed with gauging regard the tall, iron-haired woman pacing in front of him. Off to one side sat the Gilk Bargast Spax, even drunker than Gaul, his own red-shot, bleary gaze tracking the mortal sword as she sought to prize from Gaul every last detail regarding the Malazans. Where had this sudden uncertainty come from? Had not the Perish sworn to serve the adjunct? Oh, if Queen Abrastel could witness what he was witnessing. But then she'd be interested in all the unimportant matters, wouldn't she? Eager to determine if the Great Alliance was weakening, and all that. All the while missing the point, the matters that were truly interesting and so sharply relevant to this scene before him. The war leader's wife was nowhere to be seen, and it had already occurred to Spax that he should probably leave. Who knew if or when Krughava would finally take note of the look in Gaul's eyes, and what might she do then? Instead, Spax sat sprawled in the leather sling of the three-legged chair, too comfortable to move and, it had to be admitted, too fascinated as she fired question after question into the increasingly senseless arrow butt that was Gaul. When would she realize that the man had stopped answering? That while she went on attacking and attacking, he'd stopped defending long ago? He so wanted to see that moment, her expression, yes, one he could take away with him and remember forevermore. What would it take for her to notice?
If he pulled out his gooseneck and took aim, would that do it? Or just wrestled his way out of his clothes? Gods below, the drooling's not done it.
He should leave, but they'd have to drag him out of this tent.
Come on, Krughava, you can do it. I know you can. Take a second look, woman, at the man you're talking to.
No, he wasn't going anywhere. Ah, but this was a most agitated woman. Something about a weakening resolve, or was it a failure of confidence, a sudden threat from within the ranks of the Grey Helms themselves? Someone missing in the command structure, the necessary balance all awry. A young man of frightening ambitions. Oh, swamp spirits be damned, he was too drunk to make sense of any of this.
Why am I sitting here? What is she saying? Pay attention, Krughava. Never mind him. Can't you see this bulge? No one wants the goose to honk. Come and strangle it, woman. I'll solve your agitation. Yes, if only you women understood that. Your every answer right here between my legs. Half the world's mired in ignorance. Half the world. Gooseneck.